So it's 11:30 and we should start. And the way we traditionally start is, first of all, I should say welcome and hello to everybody. It's great to see everybody here. Lots of new faces, and that's wonderful. My name is Lama Tom Broadwater. They allow me on the premises once a month to teach. So if you came to see Lama Kathy, I'm sorry, I'm going to disappoint you. So, but how we begin is, generally we begin with refuge and bodhicitta. If you know that prayer, you're welcome to say it along with me. If you don't, simply offer the your being here for the benefit of all beings. Whatever you learn or whatever you take home with you, hopefully it will benefit both you and all beings. So, sounds like it's getting louder. I guess that's good. Can you hear me good? Okay. Sanje Chidang Sakhi Choknam La Janju Badu Dagni Kyapsu Chi Dagi Jin So Chi Pe Sonam Ki Drola Pinshir Sanje Drupasho Sanje Chidang Sakhi Choknam La Janju Badu Dagni Kyapsu Chi Dagi Jin So Chi Pe Sanam Ki Drola Pin Shir Sanje Drupar Sho Sanje Chidang Sakhi Choknam La Janju Badu Dagni Kyapsu Chi Dagi Jin So Chi Pe So Nam Ki Drola Pin Shir Sanje Drupar Sho. There's some seats up here if you want to come up. So, again, welcome. I'm glad you all could come here today. It looks like we have a full house. That's wonderful. Did we take admission? Only joking. I am very happy to be here. It's a real privilege and a pleasure to be here. This is a wonderful center, and you have soon to look forward to a new, brand new center to be built. Many people have worked very hard for that possibility to actualize. So, you know, you've got a lot to look forward to. Your best days are ahead. Anyway, so what am I doing today? I actually have an outline of what I'm going to do, and basically it's from this book called The Way of the Bodhisattva. It's basically a text from an 8th century saint by the name of Shantideva, and a bodhisattva is basically the ideal, the sort of the saint of the Mahayana, and what he's talking about in the beginning of this book, and I've already done one chapter, we're going to chapter 2 today, he talks about the thought of bodhicitta. And that thought is the greatest thought any human being can have. It is the thought that I will awaken, not only for myself, but for all beings. Why is that a great thought? Well, I'm just going to ask you, what kinds of thoughts did you have coming here this morning? Most of them were probably neutral, like how do I get here through this fog? That's my thought. Watch out, don't hit that car, which I almost did. You know, or, you know, just all kinds of little stupid things that go in my mind. I don't know that between here and Zanesville, where I live, I had too many virtuous thoughts. And I don't know about you, but that's probably your experience too. It's most people's experience. We sort of go in a fog in a real sense in our minds. And only once in a while do we think something virtuous. This thought that I will awaken for all beings is the greatest thought we can have. Shanti Davis said in the first chapter that it's sort of like lightning in the sky in the middle of a summer storm. It strikes, we see it, and it's gone. And that's how most of our good thoughts are. They might light up the sky for a moment, but they dissipate and they're gone. So this book is really about, how do I keep this thought in mind? First of all, how do I generate this thought? And then, how do I keep it going? And then finally, the last couple chapters are about how do I intensify that thought. So right now, we are on this first phase of how do I generate this thought? How do I keep this good thought in mind? And he said, well, there are causes and conditions for good thoughts, for a continuous virtue. And he said in this chapter, the second chapter, he said there are a couple ways. One way we can do it is simply with an attitude maybe of gratitude, offer all of the good things that we see in a given day, offer them up to enlightened beings. Lama Kathy said in one of her little, PDFs, he said, making offering, and this is what it's all about, this is the whole first couple verses, is about making offerings to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And she says, do it as often as you can. She says, when you see something beautiful, a sunset, a flower, a tree, a person, anything, mentally offer it to the Buddhas, the enlightened beings, for the benefit of all suffering beings. Offer your meals. Offer anything new you buy for yourself or receive from others. And your store of merit will increase, and your wish to achieve Buddhahood for the benefit of all beings will increase. It is inevitable that if you do this kind of practice, just when you get up in the morning, if it's a beautiful day, offer that beautiful day to the Buddhas for the benefit of all beings. That starts engendering this idea that I'm going to awaken, and I'm going to awaken for all beings. You don't have to have actual things in front of you. You could offer, say, last year you were at the beach and you had this beautiful experience of being at the beach. I offer to all enlightened beings all the beautiful beaches in this world and all universes, so that all beings and myself will come to Buddha. You can do that. And you know what? It's so easy. It sounds like, you know, almost too easy. And it is. But you get so much merit. Merit meaning that it opens us up to future benefit. So the first couple of stanzas, actually the first 30 stanzas, are about making offerings. Now, Shanti Deva, who was in the 8th century, used offerings that were traditional to where he was in India. You know, parasols and these kind of things and palaces and stuff like that. Those are probably not expressions that we use today. So I'm not even going to recite that part. I'm going to skip that. I'm just going to say, Lama Kathy's got a good idea about anything that comes across your path you can offer. So again, we're talking about what are the conditions that create bodhicitta, this desire to awaken for the benefit of all beings. So I will go to the book itself. I'm going to read to you a bit. And I'm sorry, some of us don't like to be read to, but, you know, his words are probably a lot better than mine, so I'm going to use his words if I have my glasses on. He says, and this is another way to develop this idea of awakening for the benefit of all beings. Until the essence of enlightenment is reached, I will go to refuge to the Buddhas, and I will take refuge in the Dharma and to all the hosts of Bodhisattva. So he's saying that one of the conditions for having this thought to awaken for the benefit of all beings is to go to refuge in the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the Sangha. What we just said when we first began was that we call it a refuge prayer. That's a misnomer. It's not a prayer. It's a vow. It's a pledge. We're pledging that we'll take refuge in the Buddha, who is enlightened, his Dharma, that was his teaching, and those that follow those teachings, which are the Bodhisattvas. Refuge, and I'll sort of digress for a moment here, refuge is really the opening, the door opening us to the Buddhist path. I'm sure you know that there are various different sects and branches to Buddhism that exist today. But common to all of them is the notion that one has to first take refuge. And that opens us to the door of blessing, and it opens us to the door of this thought that I will awaken. So then he goes on, he says, to perfect Buddhas and to Bodhisattvas in all directions, wherever they may reside, to them who are the sovereigns of great mercy, I press my palms together, praying thus. So basically he's visualizing this field of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And he's going to now give us the next condition for this aspiration or this great thought of awakening. And he says it's confession. That we have to make a confession. Why would that be? I remember when I was a long time ago, when I was a Catholic, you had to go to confession, you know, to the priest. I remember my first confession. I was 6 years old. What do six-year-old kids do that's horrible? I remember I actually couldn't think of anything. So I made something up. I said I stole an apple from my next-door neighbor. So I lied in order to confess. Buddhist confession is a little different. There's a ritual we can go about. And one of the rituals is, and I'll be very brief about this, we can imagine Buddhas in front of us and we're making confession to them. And I see confession a little bit differently than confessing a sin. I see it more about recognizing where we're at the moment. It's just where we're at. It's, you know, it's like we got faults. And unless we recognize we have some things that are problematic about our behavior or about the way we think, if we don't recognize that, how will we ever progress? So it's a point of humbly recognizing where we're at, not being too bent out of shape about it. It's certainly not about, and I'll use another tradition, it's not about sackcloth and ashes. It's about humbly recognizing where you're at. So Shantideva is going to give us some advice on how to make a confession. He said, in this and all my lives, while turning in the round without beginning, in other words, being in this cyclic existence of clinging and suffering and so forth, and having done that from the beginning, blindly I have brought forth evil and incited others to do so. That's a frank admission on the part of a saint, isn't it? But it's all of our stories. Deceived and overmastered by my ignorance, I have taken pleasure in sin. Ooh, sin. This is a translation, but it's not an error. We often like to use the words fault, and fault is a fine word, but sin is probably okay too. We just don't put God into it or think of punishment as divinely ordained. Sin is some fault we have committed, and the consequence is karmic. It's just inevitable. It's the result of our karma. It's not a punishment from the divine. And if we cut all that stuff out, we can still use the word sin, and it's okay. If you want fault, that's okay too. So, deceived and overmastered by my ignorance, I have taken pleasure in sin, and seeing how the blame, and seeing now the blame of it, O great protectors, I confess this earnestly. So I confess it from my heart. So I think in order to make progress on this path, we have to recognize where we are. And where we are is that we have caused harm to ourselves and others. No big deal. We're not special in that. I'm not special because I have faults. Whatever I have done against the Triple Gem, the Buddha, the Sangha, and the Dharma, whatever I've done against the Triple Gem, against my parents, teachers, and the rest, through the force of my defilements in body, speech, and mind. So that's over many lifetimes. I've done lots of things. We think about this lifetime as what we've done. Well, we've got the karma from beginningless time of all that karma we've got built up. And the evil I, a sinner, have committed, all the wicked deeds that cling to me. So it's sort of like our faults cling to us like rust clings to iron. You know, it sticks with us. The frightful things I have contrived, I openly declare to you, the teachers of the world. It may be that my death will come to me before my evil has been cleansed. How then can I be freed from it? I pray you, quickly grant me your protection. How do I know when I'm going to die? In fact, this morning when I was cutting across lanes, I almost got bumped into and could have been killed. That's because of my carelessness, not because some. But we could walk out of here today, right now, be run over by a car, or hurt, or killed. I'm not trying to upset you, but I'm just trying to tell you the truth, okay? I don't want to upset you, but it's the truth. It may be that my death will come to me before my evil has been cleansed. How then can I be freed from it? I pray you quickly grant me your protection. So the next part of confession is reliance. We rely on enlightened ones to help us, to guide us. We cannot trust the wanton lord of death. This is a personification. There is no such thing as the Lord of Death. It's just the way he spoke. It's death. We cannot trust the wanton Lord of Death. The task complete or still to do, he will not wait. In health or sickness, therefore, none of us can trust our fleeting momentary lives. And we must pass away, forsaking all. But I, devoid of understanding, have, for sake of friend or foe alike, provoked and brought about so many wrongs. So we've done wrong because our friends may have been influenced by our friends, or because we wanted to protect our friends or whatnot. We've certainly done wrong to our enemies, to our foes. We've all done that. But all my foes will cease to be. All my friends will cease to be, and I will cease to be, and likewise everything will cease to be. All that I possess and use is like the fleeting vision of a dream. It fades into the realms of memory, and fading will be seen no more. This is getting depressing, isn't it? But it's true. It's not trying to depress you. It's just trying to make you look. Everything you have, everything you own, everything you cling to at death, you don't have. And that's all he's saying. And even in the brief course of this present life, so many friends and foes have passed away. Believe me, I look in the obituaries now in my hometown, and people are passing off all the time. I'm getting at that age too, isn't it? But you'll find the same thing one of these days. So many friends and foes have passed away, because of whom the evils I have done still lie unbearable before me. So what he's saying there is that all these people will pass away, but the things I have done, the wrongs I have done, either for them or against them, that will remain. My karma is sort of like my shadow. It always lies either in latency or in fact in front of me or behind me, depending upon where the sun shines. But it's always going to be there. And it's the same with our karma. That's what he's saying. That so all these people will pass away, but what I've done will not. Never holding day or night, my life drains away constantly, and from no other source does increase come. I can't get help from any other source. I have to work on it. How can there not be death for such as me? So he's basically saying, you know, you only have so many years, so much of a lifespan. It's just, that's the way it is. And you can't increase it. The Buddha will not increase your lifespan. It's what's karmically set out for you. So, what's this all about? He's pointing out the importance of confessing now, not waiting till tomorrow, where you're at, so that you can really begin to awaken. That's all he's saying. Recognize where you're at. First of all, that you're going to pass away. And if you wait, it may well be too late. There I'll be prostrate on my bed, and all around my family and friends, if you're lucky. But I alone shall be the one to feel the cutting of the thread of life. I work for a program called No One Should Die Alone. The fact is, there are many people that die alone, particularly as you grow older, or else you've done so many things to hurt people that nobody wants to be at your deathbed. And I was really surprised the first couple times that I witnessed people's death. You know, you have this sort of idea that people quietly pass away. It's not always the case. Many gasp and are moaning and groaning, and yeah, the nurses tell me that's often the result of people recounting events in their own lives, that they're taking account that sometimes happens. So it's not always a peaceful thing. So if you're planning on waiting on your deathbed to make a full confession, and everything will be okay, and don't plan on it. It may not be so. You have now. You may not have then. And that's what Shanti Devi is saying. And when the heralds of the deadly king have gripped me, what help to me will be my friends and kin? For then life's virtue is my one defense. And this, alas, is what I've shrugged away. Wow. So the only defense you have at the time of your death will be your virtuous thoughts, your virtuous deeds, your thought that I will awaken for the benefit of all beings. And if you don't have that, you'll have nothing. And to think that so much of our life, we shrug away that idea, I'll do that later. I'll think of that tomorrow. So he goes on, O protector's eye, so little heeding, hardly guessed at horror such as this, and all for this brief and transient existence, I have done so many evil things. So he's basically saying, I have failed to recognize what I should do, and I failed to recognize what I should not do. He never took the time. This is a saint talking here. I mean, how much more is it for ourselves? The day they take him to the sky, now this really gets a little macabre, so bear with me, keep going. The day they take him to the scaffold, where they will tear off his limbs, a man is changed, transfigured by his fear. His mouth is dry, his eyes start from his brow. No need to say how stricken I shall be. When overcome and sick with dreadful fear, I am seized by forms so horrible to see, the frightful servants of the Lord of Death. Wow, that's pretty. But he's trying to shake us up a bit here, isn't he? He's trying to make us see. But in the four directions, no protection shall I find, and I shall sink into despairing woe. No refuge will be there for me. At such a time, what shall I do? Thus, from this day forward, now we get to the next part of confession, which is the strength of support, the support of enlightened beings. Thus, from this day forward, I take refuge in the Buddhas, guardians of beings who labor to protect all wanderers, those mighty ones who scatter every fear. They say when you take refuge, you become fearless. You're granted fearlessness. And in the Dharma, they have realized in their hearts, which drives away the terrors of samsara, and in all the hosts of bodhisattvas, likewise, I will perfectly take refuge. You know, the Buddha is no longer with us. And we don't always know or recognize the people that are following him perfectly. So what you and I as beginners have to take refuge in more than anything else is the Buddha's instructions, the Dharma. That is, as beginners, the most important refuge. So, take an interest, and I'm saying this as much to myself as to you, take an interest in the teachings, because it is through the teachings we will get into the door of liberation. Gripped by dread, beside myself with anguish, to Samantabhadra, I will give myself. My body, I myself will give to Manjugosha, gentle and melodious. These are basically Buddhas. To him whose deeds of mercy never fail, my Lord Avalokita, which is another name for Chinrezi, who is basically, Avalokita means the Lord who watches over us, who sees with the eyes of compassion. I cry out from depths of misery, protect me now, an evildoer. Formerly, your words I have transgressed, but having seen these terrors all around, I come to you for refuge, praying, swift, drive away my fear. For if, alarmed by common ailments, I must implement the doctor's words, what need to speak of when I'm constantly brought low by ills like lust and faults a hundredfold? He's basically saying, you know, if we go to the doctor for our ills, How much more do we know, need to go to the Buddha and to his instructions to cure the ills of our minds and hearts? How much more so? And if by one of these alone the dwellers in the world are all thrown down, and if no other remedy exists, no other healing elsewhere to be found than words of the all-knowing doctor, the Buddha, which uproot every evil, the thought to turn on him deaf ears is abject and contemptible stupidity. Basically, he's saying, you've got this precious human birth, and to waste it now, Nagarjuna, or Nagarjuna, depends on how you pronounce it, has said, if we waste this life, it is like we pick up vomit with a jeweled golden scoop. What's he mean by that? That's pretty... He means that we have this beautiful vessel, our body, our life, and if what we do is pick up our misdeeds, bad deeds, vomit, crap, we've wasted our life. That's what he's saying. I mean, these are really... Okay, so it's like that. Don't waste your life. Along a small and ordinary cliff, if I must pick my way with special care, what need to speak of the long-lasting chasm plunging into the depths a thousand leagues? In other words, we have to be careful at what we choose to do and what we choose not to do. Because choosing wrongly winds us up. And if you don't believe in hell realms, I personally do, but if you don't, you know that your actions can plunge you into hellish states. You know that. You've done it. I've done it. We've lived in hellish states. And so if we're not careful about what we choose to do and what we choose not to do, we're going to fall off into that hellish realm. And we have already. We've done it many times. Today at last, I shall not die. Excuse me, today at least, I shall not die. That's what we think. Now, I'm not going to die today. So, Raishtra, lull myself into words like these. My disillusion and my hour of death will come to me. Of this, there is no doubt. So, when we say, and we often do, right? I'm not going to die today. That's carefree nonchalance. And it's not true. You may die today. I may die today. Who can give me fearlessness? What sure escape is there from this? It's certain that I'm going to die, so how can I relax my mind at ease? Of life's experiences, all seasons pass. What's left to me? What now remains? By clinging to what now is here no more, my teacher's precepts I have disobeyed. He's saying we all cling to pleasure. When our consciousness comes against an object that's pleasurable, we experience pleasure. But as surely as they make contact, they will separate. And we fail to recognize all the pleasures of this life are just that, temporary. But the moment, he's saying, the moment we recognize that all pleasures are temporary and that all clinging to them is causing us unhappiness, at that point we're ready to enter a spiritual life. We're able to recognize that. Now, don't get me wrong. We can experience pleasure, and it's perfectly. We're not in sackcloth and ashes. We're not in the desert, and we're not monks or nuns. We can experience, I'm sure they experience pleasure too, though. but we can experience, but we just don't try to hold on to it. We recognize its impermanence. And if we can do that, we're in that gateway towards happiness, to true happiness. So hang in there. We just got four more lines, four more stanzas. And when this life is left behind, and with it all kith and kin, I must set out on strange paths all alone. Why make so much of my friends and foes? Because neither of them can, you know, assist me at the time of death. So now the final part, resolve. This is the final part of confession, to resolve. How instead can I make sure to rid myself of evil, only cause of suffering? That should be my one concern, my only thought day and night. So he's saying we should keep in mind what we should be doing and what we should not be doing. And we should always have in our mind where we are right now. Where are we right now in terms of our path? And recognize it. That's confession. The wrongs that I have done through ignorant stupidity, all actions evil by their nature and transgressions of the precepts, fearing all the pains to come, I join my hands and ceaselessly prostrate, and everything I confess directly in the sight of my protectors. I pray you, guides and guardians of the world, to take me as I am, a sinful man, and all these actions, evil as they are, I promise, this is the resolve, I promise never again to do. So, what's the major points here? I think the major points are that our karma is like a shadow that follows us. And there is this need on our part to recognize the fact that we have done, we have our faults and defects, and that there are ways of purifying that. As I began, we can offer, get up in the morning and offer beautiful thoughts, beautiful sights to the Buddhas. We can make confession. There are various purification activities. I was just engaged, was it last week? The Nune, was that last week? Last week we did a 2.5 day Nune, a purification practice. And I think everyone felt lighter as a result of it. So what he's saying, the bad news is we do have faults. The good news is we can purify those faults. And one of the ways is confession. So what time is it? Oh, good. I got some more time. So I want to give you one more quick story, two stories. And I want, you know, sometimes we talk about bodhisattvas and we sort of have ideas about them, but we really don't see them concretely. So I'm going to give you, these are not, probably they won't go in the canon of Buddhist saints or bodhisattvas, but there are people in this day and age that we can look up to and admire and see their bodhisattva actions, their actions of wanting to awaken and to benefit other beings. These individuals, I think, have benefited other beings. The first fellow is by the name of Captain Thompson. How many of you have been born since 1968? Most of you. Many of you, anyway. Captain Thompson was a helicopter pilot in the Vietnam War back in 1968, March 16th of 1968, a horrible atrocity occurred, My Lai Massacre, where 500 Vietnamese men, mostly women, children, and old people were murdered, slaughtered. Captain Thompson was in his helicopter looking down on the scene. And like most of us, we'd look and we couldn't figure out exactly what was going on. He's sort of in a fog. And then all of a sudden, he realized all these people were being slaughtered by his own people. So without further thought, he landed his helicopter, got out, and between the troops and him and those that were being slaughtered, he said, "Stop." Even after 500 were killed, there were still others left. And he ferried many of them off back to safety. He came back a second time, and he picked up, he saw in the ditch, they apparently had made these people dig ditches and they murdered them in the ditches. And he saw a little boy was crawling out of the ditch, and he picked him up, and he was the last one to be taken out, and he couldn't come back because he'd run out of gas. I looked at Mr. Thompson's background, read about it, because I think he's really an interesting character. There is nothing in his background that would suggest anything out of the ordinary. He was an altar boy he was an altar boy. That was the only thing that sort of stood out. And yet he did this incredibly beautiful act of saving human beings. Subsequently, he told that story repeatedly until someone listened to him, and that became a congressional investigation during which Senator John Stennis recommended that Mr. Thompson be tried for treason. We think our times are difficult. Look back then. So he wasn't congratulated. It wasn't until 30 years later that he actually got some recognition from the Army. The person that committed these atrocities, or was the leader of these atrocities, was the name of Lieutenant Calley. He served 2.5 years he was given a life sentence, but Nixon pardoned him, and he was given 2.5 years of in-house arrest for murdering 500 people. You'd like to think that after that, Mr. Thompson lived a beautiful life. He didn't. He had post-traumatic stress. He had alcoholism as a problem. He had a number of problematic divorces. He died in 2006. One of the buddies who was with him in the helicopter, he was the only person with him at the time of his death. Calley, on the other hand, is still alive. He's a jeweler in Georgia. But if it's any consolation or whatever you want to say, he's only given one public talk, and that was to Kiwanis Club in Georgia. And he said, "There is not a day that goes by that I am not haunted by that scene." So why am I telling you this story? Well, I'm telling you this story because there are people out there that do the right thing. They don't get glory for it. They don't get praised about it. They just do it. That's very dramatic. Most of us, you and me, probably will never have that sort of opportunity to intervene in such evil times. We probably won't. You and I have the mundane responsibilities of smiling at the cashier at Walmart who's unhappy. We can intervene there. It's not heroic. We won't get a Congressional Medal of Honor. But it is the accumulation of those kinds of things that bring merit to us, that bring us to awakening, that brings us to the aspiration, action, to actually help other beings. We will not probably do those dramatic things. But at the same time, we can always practice just in case it does happen. We'll be ready for it. I think our lives as bodhisattvas are more like Doc Martin. Anybody seen Doc Martin? Yeah, a couple of you. He's a fictional character on PBS. It's an English drama. Doc Martin is a cranky old guy that couldn't be a surgeon because he didn't like to. He vomited at the sight of blood. So he winds up sort of in a retired, beautiful community in seaside England. And when he first got there, he was a great doctor, but he was always, I think he's probably a little autistic. He never empathized with his patients. If they said, get out of here, after he's finished with them. And he caused chaos and confusion all the time in that community. But I've watched it for 8 seasons, and I've seen him little by little start to be empathetic, start to be understanding, and starting to actually be helpful to other people. Recently, in the last episode I just watched, if you think I'm really into this one. It's 8 seasons. And I'm almost finished the last one. He actually said to someone, "Thank you." And that person who knew him since he's been, is Port Wayne is where he's at, who knew he was being a brusque and unhappy kind of a person. And when he said thank you to them, they went, they felt really good, and it sort of made it. So I think we're sort of like Doc Martens. Our awareness of other people and their suffering slowly, slowly, over the course of 8 seasons, starts to develop. We start to say, oh, this person suffers just like me. I want to be a better person because I want to be able to help that person. So we may never be, the Thompsons of the world, but we can be the Doc Martens. We can slowly over time, through practice each day, practice, for example, of making offerings, through the practice of confession, we can develop this notion that I will awaken for the benefit of all beings. That's all I have to say. Anybody have any thoughts, questions, or anything else that's on your mind?
Hi, Lama Tom.
Good morning.
Yeah, I guess I just thought I'd take advantage of it. You have like a rudimentary knowledge of Latin?
Rudimentary, yes.
Sometimes I think of this Catholic saying, memento mori. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
It's like, remember your death.
Yes, okay. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure, mori. I thought it was morir. But
whatever.
And I've never watched many Doc Martin episodes, but the one episode I did see, he backed up, he was like making a house call or something, and he gets in his car and he backs up and he runs over a little dog. I don't know if you saw that episode. And I thought, that guy is out to lunch. I kind of pride myself that I haven't run over an animal since 1996.
Good.
And you can do that if you drive mindfully.
You're right.
Some people say to me, "Oh no, no, no! When I ran over that rabbit, or that squirrel, it just came out of nowhere, and there's no time at all. And I said, no, you probably, if you paid more attention, and then they'd hate to hear that because I'm preaching to them, but I...
Yeah. So I think one of the things we'd say is that on this path, if we're serious about it, we have to be careful. And actually, that's another chapter in this book, carefulness.
So I appreciated your comment about the small things we do every day.
Yes.
It's going to be significant.
Yes.
And so I wanted to share that the World Health Organization said that there are more deaths from suicide than all the wars and homicides combined. Mm. Of course, a lot of the suicides are probably connected to war and homicides from PTSD, but and other effects. But that's a big motivation for me every day, just to be kind and to recognize other people and treat them with dignity and make eye contact, even if they're just fast food people. You really are preventing suicide.
I thank you. That's a very good point. We, you know, if we approach everybody from the standpoint they're suffering just like me, how much good we would do. And it is, you know, it is heroic to do ordinary acts of kindness. Why? Because it takes a certain amount of mindfulness, a certain amount of discipline. It's not always easy. Thank you.
And you also find that you feel better too, so it gets easier once you practice these things.
Yes.
So my question is, you talked in your talk today about asking for help from the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So does that mean that there is an external, like that they're actually going to help me by projecting something externally onto me, or am I doing that as a way to train my mind?
I'm going to give you my answer, and I'm not saying it's authoritative. It is a skillful way to open up your own heart, to approach the Buddhas, thinking that the Buddhas want nothing more and nothing less than your own happiness. They have this part of the hook. By your asking, you form the relationship. It's like that. So that way of thinking, that image of the Buddhas helping us, is a skillful way to operate. Does that make sense? And if it doesn't, just say so.
Well, so, yeah, does that mean that... Yeah, I guess... So I still don't understand whether that means that there's an external force out there that's waiting for me to ask, and or whether this is all happening in my mind. You know, so is this all encased in my mind?
Wow, or? Excellent question. And I don't know that I can fully answer it. And I see Lama Kathy back there too. So if I get in trouble and if I dig a ditch, yeah, get me out of it. This image of the Buddhas is relative. It's a relative truth. It points to an ultimate truth. The ultimate truth is you are already enlightened. But relatively speaking, we need the supports of the Buddhas in order to bring that out. So it's like that. When I make prostrations to this shrine, I'm making, relatively speaking, I am making prostrations to the Buddhas. In the Bodhisattvas. Ultimately, I am prostrating before my own enlightened nature. That doesn't help either, huh?
No, that actually did help me. So. I think I have some more studying to do.
What do you think, Lama Kathy? Oh, she has laryngitis, oh no.
I have laryngitis.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I've been tested. I don't have the flu, but I'm still going to be elbowing people today. The answers are great, and I can see how that last one helped. But if the question is, are the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas really there? Yeah, they're really there. That's according to the teaching of Kempo Carter Rinpoche, because when an enlightened being passes away, they don't go out of existence. Mm-hmm. They continue to exist in some manner, in some way. And it's just like you said earlier, they want nothing more than for us to become Buddhas also. So it's all of the things that you said, but I don't know if you wanted to know if they really exist and if they really are capable of helping. The answer is, yes, they really exist. Yes, they're capable of helping, but the extent to which they can help us is somewhat limited by our own karma and what we can see. Like the old joke about the man on the roof of the house where the flood is coming up, and he's on the roof of the house and he's praying, God, please come and save me from the roof of my house. A helicopter comes by and the man waves it away saying, no, God's going to save me.
Right.
You've heard this joke, right? It's an endless joke. And what happens at the end is that he sends away the man in the boat, he sends away the man in the helicopter, and then the floodwaters overcome him and he dies, and he meets God at the pearly gates and says, God, why didn't you save me? I prayed to you. And he said, didn't you see the guy in the boat? And so the idea is that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas do have enlightenment is a state of great capability and great dynamism, but our extent to connect to it is somewhat blunted by our own karma and what we can perceive. Does that help? Okay.
Yeah, and part of that too, isn't it, that our devotion is necessary too. I have to develop a certain amount of devotion.
And this goes exactly with your original answer, which was that praying to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, praying to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas opens your heart to the potential of being helped.
Yes, thank you.
I'm just, you know, thank you.
Thank you. I can always rely on you. Good morning.
Morning. This is a question about, I guess, how to apply bodhicitta, maybe generosity. I think maybe everybody here may have already have gone through the same thing. But just this week, I was leaving Kroger, and a guy kind of laying on a bench said, he asked me for money. And I was like, I said, you want some food? He said, no. So I kind of grunted and walked away, decided that he was just going to buy alcohol. And that's a judgment I made. Could be right, could be wrong. And again, at the gas station yesterday, a lady came up to me as I was pumping the gas, and she's like, sir, can I ask you a question? And she starts to cry. And I don't know, again, maybe I'm wrong, but I just gave her like a stern look, like I thought she was trying to take advantage of me with her tears. And she just stopped and said, oh, okay. And she walked away to her car. And then she drives away. It's kind of a, you know, a small pickup with a lot of damage in the front. And then I'm left. I was talking with my wife about it, like, you know, was I right about that? Was she really in distress? Maybe I was wrong. And I felt bad about it.
Yes, okay.
So the question is, like, I thought I heard Kempo said once, well, you know, when individuals ask you for money, it's okay to give a buck. Give a buck. Well, I didn't give a buck in either situation. And, you know, if I misjudge and I'm given a buck, and the guy's, you know, applying it to a bottle or what have you.
Yeah.
Am I incurring negative karma, or is my intention good enough that it would be okay?
Well, your question, first of all, is what do I do? And prior to what you do, the most important thing is your motivation. Whatever you do, it has to be with the motivation of benefit. So in one respect, it's not so terribly important whether you gave or didn't give. It's what was your motivation for either giving or not giving. If your motivation in not giving was, I don't want them to drink alcohol, not a bad motivation. If your motivation is, I'll give them the dollar, I don't know what he's going to do with it. I hope that he uses it for food. That's a good motivation. it's not a good motivation, and it would be wrong to say withhold it because you didn't like the way he looked, or because he's poor, or those kind of things. So I can't give you a direct answer. You can either give him the dollar or not. The important thing is you search your own mind as to why you're doing what you're doing and figure that out. And the only proper motivation for either doing or not doing is to benefit them. Personally, I'd give him the dollar. Personally, I'd do that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so, you know, I'd like to give you a, you know, dogmatic answer, but I can't. I can only tell you that the most important thing any of us need to engage in when we're searching our minds, when we're looking at what to confess, is what were our intentions. We can actually do something that looks very good to everybody in the world, but we have the worst motivation possible. So we have to be careful about that. But I'd probably give him the dollar. Anybody else have anything they want to? What time is it? All right, right on the button. So what we do now is the fact you came here today, the fact that you are wanting to be a better person is a very good thing. What I want you to do to extend the merit of this is to think over, not my faltering words, but the thoughts behind what I've said today. Think about that. Contemplate that. See where in your own lives you can put it into practice in little ways. And for now, what I'd ask you to do, instead of clinging to this idea that somehow I've done something good, take this merit, this openness that you have developed today, and offer it for all suffering beings. And as someone pointed out, everybody we meet is suffering in some way or another. Everyone. So offer this quietly in your own heart for the benefit of all beings. Thank you, and you all have a great week.